For moon, read morn. For limb, read lamb. For cuckoo, read cockerel. For thundered, read thundering. For quiet, read quake.
You're listening to a Scottish Poetry Library podcast.
Hello, this is Jennifer Williams, Programme Manager at the Scottish Poetry Library, and I am here at the 2015 Stanza International Poetry Festival, whom this podcast is recorded in association with, and I am sitting with the New Zealand poet John Dennison, who has a debut collection called Otherwise, which is it's just out, isn't it, really?
That's right.
With Carcanet. He grew up and studied in... Well, you grew up in Tawa.
Mm-hmm.
Tawa, am
That's
I saying
right.
that right?
Yeah.
Lived and studied in Wellington, Dunedin, and St. Andrews, Scotland. So coming back to Stanza is a bit of a homecoming in some ways. And you now live with your family in Wellington, where you are a university chaplain. It's a real pleasure to get to speak to you today, John, and thank you
That's
for coming all the way over. I know you're doing a bit of a tour while you're here as well, so hopefully folks in other parts of the UK will get to hear a bit of you while you're here. But it would be lovely, first of all, to hear a poem from you, and then we'll talk some more.
Great. Thanks, Jim. This is called Seeing It Through, and it's an ekphraxis of a painting by Ferdinand Hodler. The painting's The Sick Valentine, Gerda de Weil, from 1914, Seeing It Through. After all, your eyes, hand, will traverse the contours nearly, things unfinished turning together, not unlike landscape, but artless, aware of what rises in the bone, knowing we are prone to it and must see it through. And isn't that just so? God help us. You make your bed and lie in it, honestly. A time was when you saw it plain. But look, here's the thing, the contours of your passing, folds and fills of big clothes mounding to a horizon of opaque deposits, and these laid over an unrelieved presence, your head blankly enhaloed. And the lips read, truly, beloved, we are not perspicuous to ourselves. We are drawn still by death's gas mask bouquet, setting at the end of what we've made of it, a stopper, a knocker, a mouth that denies the art that becomes us, through which we might see, lift mine eyes, that the world's high clock is hanged by a cross. And how? Hold the sheet up to the light. See your face coming through.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear you read it, because reading the poems on my own at home, they're full of such a potent music. But I was very curious about in your accent, which I hadn't heard yet, what the ringing of those sounds would be like. It's really nice to hear them. Do you, well, there's so many things I want to ask you about these poems, about the sound, the way they're constructed. There's some interesting use of rhyme, but not necessarily end rhyme in there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, internal rhyme tends to surprise me. It's not something that I aim for.
I love that when it sneaks up on you.
Yeah.
It just sort of gets...
Yeah, it does. So, you know, that poem that rises in the bone, knowing we are prone to it. I mean, rhyme is more of a driving thing when I'm writing into a rima or in a sonnet. And then it tends to be definitely slant and skewed and pushed and pulled around. But I found certainly the terza rima form wonderfully liberating from being released from the tyranny of Freeverse, and like where everything's up for grabs, and you have to choose. You choose where the line ends, and you choose. And that after a while, it just the arbitrariness of that. It's like selection fatigue in the supermarket. There's a sense that everything's up for grabs, and you have to choose, and therefore, it becomes kind of meaningless, perhaps. But the Terzarima poems is interesting because you're kind of getting ahead of yourself and reaching forwards to something constantly, with the way the rhyme scheme anticipates what must come. So it's kind of promissory sort of form, I guess. Mm. Enables you to live forward into what you cannot know by definition before you get there. Mm. Yeah.
That makes me think of, and I wonder if you think of this consciously or if you notice it, that this idea that form can actually tie into the philosophy or the content that is behind a poem.
Yeah. I'm still exploring this. The idea of the poem is a microeconomy, I suppose, in that the possibilities and the commitments that it does or doesn't entail draw you into the free verse economy feels a bit too close to, say, our late capitalist consumerist kind of thing. That it troubles me as a verse form because of what I experience is a tyranny of the choosing, individuating self. I mean, that's a very strong politicised way of coming at it. And I'm not suggesting that freeform isn't needful at points. I think it is needful, but there has to be that necessity about it, the sense that this is the fitting way to come at this thing. Whereas to write in a sonnet, I think, enables that negative capability, that you don't tie it all neatly up, that you have to step into that tradition and trust the language rather than use the language. But that's, part of it is the attitude towards English that you pushes you out and towards, like the poem is a boat and you push it out into the language, rather than grabbing all the words and make them do your work for the free will.
Yeah.
Sort of free choosing thing. Yeah. That's how I experience it anyway.
It's wonderful.
So there's a sense, it's almost as if, to just totally confuse the metaphor, if the poem is a pool or something, the rhymes rise up through it, and you have to wait for them.
In your boat, in the pool. These are watery metaphors. Yeah. No, it's interesting.
Yeah.
Do you live by the water? Wellington is on the seas.
Yeah, no, I don't live by the water. Oh. I mean, the sea's always there, but no, it's. I'm just grasping at straws to explain the process.
No, it's really fascinating. I think it's so interesting because I feel like there would have been a time when people thought free verse was an escape from, you know, the tyranny of a formal, you know, this kind of necessity to fit into these very tight structures.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting to come back around, which I think people do perhaps feel more and more, that actually it's so strong now, that feeling that a modern poem appears in this kind of free-form way on the page, and that there's a lot of anxiety for especially young poets often, I think, about how to make those decisions, like where should the line break go? And I've often found that the constraint of form is very freeing, actually, that once you know, there's still a decision to make, which form am I going to use? But once you make that choice, there's a very, it maybe relieves some of those other blank page anxieties, and then you can really push a lot of creativity through that filter or frame that you've chosen.
Yeah, I mean, I've experienced these things as a sort of, you set yourself in relation to a tradition, and it's a quickening, enabling thing. I suppose, I mean, lurking in this for me always is kind of a theological question, but what does it mean to be human? What is freedom? Is it freedom from constraint that we're really pitching for? Or is our freedom a slightly more complex thing of being free for certain things, not just free from certain things? And so if we think of ourselves as animals, then we have to acknowledge the way that the whole of our life is hemmed round by contingencies and things beyond us. Even my marriage is beyond me. I can't, it would be improper to kind of, you know, simply see that as a fulfillment of who I am and liberation of all of my potential or something, rather than to say when I'm bound in that relationship, it enables me to become something I can't be without. And you can't hypothesize about who you might, the kind of freedom that you might have outside of that. There's the form that you live into, and it enables you to live into the contingencies of, well, time and space, I suppose. Yeah. Yeah, this is all getting us very far from this. But the, yeah, freedom, that's, I don't experience freedom in free verse, I suppose that's the bottom line. But more and more it is about this excitement of trusting the language, and there's a kind of gratitude there if language is something that's always beyond you. It's always been, there's a kind of givenness to that, that it's a good thing to wait for the right word and for the right rhyme to surface. And
there's an image, it's in that poem, and I feel like it's perhaps in some of the other poems as well, a hanging, sort of things hanging, or it felt like a powerful one in the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, most immediately it's responding to this painting of a dying woman, and it's an early painting in a sequence that Hodler did of his mistress dying, right through to her corpse on the bed. Most remarkable sequence of paintings. And the image is unfinished, and up on the wall there's a kind of sort of clock, abstract clock, and a tiny cross on top of it. And yeah, so I was totally drawn to the kind of possibilities of mortality and time, and also the crucifixion and image of redemption. So it's not the world's clock is hung by a cross, but is hanged in this sort of sense of dealing to that time thing. But I hadn't noticed it through other
things. Yeah, I'm sure it's in at least a few others, because I really felt that.
I mean, it's even this poem, The Call, as well, yeah, that wanting to be grabbed by the scruff of the neck.
Yeah, I think it's in a few.
Plucked
out
things.
And I had just been reading Edwin Morgan's poem. I'm not sure if you know it. It's about the Salvador Dali painting, St. John on the Cross.
Oh, right.
And it's quite an extraordinary image of a crucifixion on a cross, but in that Dali-esque wonderful way, it somehow has this almost infinite drop, and it appears to be floating, and it's very vertiginous when you look at it, and it's a wonderful painting, but it really seems to capture or touch on visually these questions about our, which I was relating to in some of your poems, you know, when you're thinking about our temporal existence and having these consciousnesses that seem to float in space for a period of time, and then we're not quite sure what happens on either end, or, you know, some people have beliefs about what happened on either end, but I think it's interesting to think of us as hanging in time, and in that way it's a powerful image.
I mean, there might be, certainly I kind of, and this, I guess, what I come up against in my work as a chaplain to a degree, the there's a sort of vertigo that goes with our estate. Where that's most acute is when we're brought up, sort of brought to the end of our tether, or which is certainly an image that I keep coming back to, in that poem, we are not perspicuous to ourselves, also sums it up. So that, I mean, the title of the book is to do with not just that we're confronted by the other, but that we're otherwise, that we cannot know ourselves. The problem isn't simply be true to yourself, it's that we are in some sense estranged from ourselves from the get-go. Yeah. So there is a kind of vertigo to that, although I don't ever feel that we're abandoned in that predicament.
I'm going to ask you more about that in a moment, but yeah. I'd like to ask you to read another poem first, and then we'll talk from
there. Why don't I read the opening poem? Mm-hmm. This is a sort of atypical, I suppose, of the poems in the collection. It's a found poem. Eileen Duggan was one of New Zealand's leading poets, totally dominated poetry in New Zealand in the 1930s, 1940s, and then was eclipsed by the new nationalists, who cultural nationalists who came, and Alan Kernow and others. But I found this errata slip in a book that was published in wartime, and because it had been published in England and then shipped to New Zealand, there were errors that couldn't be fixed. So this is called Errata, after Eileen Duggan. For their death, read your death. For I had always, read I always. For nothing that, read nothing can. For moon, read morn. For limb, read lamb. For cuckoo, read cockerel. For thundered, read thundering. For quiet, read quake. For the hills river, read the hills riven. For O, read all. For and if atonement, read and is atonement. For there, read here. For as, read so. For no, read yes. These and other errors are due to war conditions.
It's so great. I mean, is that how much have you had gone in and done to it? Because it's sort of astonishing.
I mean, I kept the four read for this, read that form, and I probably tweaked every one of them actually. but I remember when I came across it, I thought this is too good.
Yeah.
And certainly the last line is.
Was that really there? Yeah, really? There.
This wartime, and she wants to say, can't do anything about it. But it resonates in all kinds of directions. Yeah, so
it's fabulous. It's great, isn't it, when you find those things that you just go, oh, that's priceless.
Yeah.
You couldn't make it up. Have you worked that way before with things that you found, or was that a new?
No, that's. It's kind of a one-off. I don't tend to.
I'm curious about how you came to poetry, and also about how you feel being a New Zealand poet, but you're, being published by Carcanet, which feels like, for instance, it's quite a long way to go for you talk to your publisher. I guess I'm curious about that, those contexts, and how that feels for you.
Spoken word was always part of family life. We had some LPs that my father would play. Carl Sandburg, reading his poems, absolutely love, still love, kind of, his just so weirdly intoned, almost homilies to America, and I just loved it. Carl Sandburg, reading his own stuff, poems by Hopkins, Eliot reading his quartets, all of those are fairly embedded in the ear. And growing up, we went to a small Brethren Assembly, so low Protestant dissenting tradition, great value placed on the teaching of Scripture and the interpretation of Scripture. So there was a sense of the word matters, words matter, and what you do with them matters. It's a kind of, words are freighted with importance, that you don't just muck around with them. But also that the language is there to be used as well. So when I got to varsity and started really eating and drinking the stuff, then I wanted to, do it myself, I suppose. I have a grandfather who wrote poems as well. It's various histories in the family of people writing. So, that's where that came from, I guess. Although the oldest poem in this book is probably 12 years old. Most of them are only 3 or 4 years old. So there's been a recent, probably post-PhD, post-Seamus, any kind of flowering thing.
So what was your PhD topic?
Was Seamus Heaney's prose writings.
And there's a beautiful sequence inspired by him.
I saw him before he died, just 10 weeks or so before he died. And our last meeting was very... I left in tears.
Aww.
Yeah, I was really disarmed, I think, particularly as a critic. I felt like he addressed me as a person rather than as a critic. I mean, that's shameless, but So I was surprised at how upset I was when he died. A colleague at Victoria Marcos is on you, gave me a research job of writing prosody notes for all of Heaney's oeuvre. So 330 poems. I had to figure out the meter and the rhyme scheme and all of these. And that wrecked my ear, actually. I started really... So a lot of the pentameterish kind of dum-de-dum thing in some of the poems is from that intense immersion in Seamus Heaney. Which I resented at the time. I'm very grateful for it now.
Mm-hmm.
What's the second part of the question?
Just wondering about your New Zealand-ness.
the distance thing. Historically, the distance thing has always been a big part of being a New Zealand European, being a Pākehā. The sense of a distance from Europe, particularly from England and Scotland, I guess. And for me, in any case, as a kind of middle-class white New Zealander, my literary imagination is English, is of a certain kind of fictional England, more Blyton and Tolkien than Dickens.
See, mine comes from Danger Mouse.
Yours is much more... Fancy.
I remember landing at Stansted the first time I came to the country and seeing hedgerows and my heart lifting.
Oh.
And
do you have those in New Zealand?
No, not in the same way. No, we do and we don't. So it's an odd sense of being at home in a foreign country and the distance. A lot of the kind of home ground of more than half of these poems is probably Scotland. So it felt right that even though these poems begin chronologically, they begin in New Zealand, it felt really nice that the book was picked up here first. And it was Kākinen who made the approach to Auckland University Press back home, actually.
Wow.
Kind
of
made it happen back home. So but the distance isn't disabling. It doesn't feel like I'm going through some post-colonial crisis.
That's good.
You can't do away with it. It's just, it is what it is.
I was just hearing a podcast with a Jamaican writer and Salman Rushdie, and they were saying they were post-colonial, so they didn't have to worry about it anymore, which is good. Okay, I feel like I've been sort of saving this up because I think it's such a, it definitely feels like a really important question, but I'd love to talk to you a little bit about
your faith, how your day job affects your writing, and you know, I don't, you can decide how personally you want to speak about it, but I do feel, certainly growing up in America and having lived for many years now in Scotland, that I went from a more religious place to a less, to a more secular place.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know people, certainly not in my age group, who go to church or who seem to carry religious beliefs for the most part. And that's been interesting for me to kind of see how I feel, how that makes me feel, where I fit in. And certainly in most of the poets I know, it doesn't seem, faith and God don't seem to be things that are being written about or engaged with much, either from a I believe in it or I don't believe in it or I'm thinking about it. It just doesn't really seem to be that much in the poetry. So I thought it was actually quite interesting and exciting to see you thinking about those things and talking about them. And
I was just with a friend at the university about this, about kind of thinking on the macro level about the big picture, particularly thinking about New Zealand, that the great patron of poetry is the university. That's where we tend to go through some kind of writing course, and that's where the centres are that offer hospitality to the poetry community often, or that it tends to be folk with university degrees who preserve, continue this perverse art. So there's that, and in New Zealand that means we don't have any church universities. Really the main universities are all secular institutions, always have been. We have church seminaries and theology schools, but by and large that university education means secular, and so I think that shapes the poetry culture. And we're always working within some sense of what's possible, sometimes with what's permissible, even if it's not explicitly said. So coming as a kid who grew up in this church, I was reading Chaim Potok's novel, My Name is Asher Lev, where he describes the Hasidic Jewish community in Brooklyn. And Brethrenism's a long way from Hasidic Jewish Orthodox practice, but something about that almost tribal religious community with a fierce sense of orthodoxy and a fierce sense of the world out there really resonated with me in my experiences. The habit of someone expounding scripture and then a kind of free-for-all, a critical Q&A about whether they'd interpreted it right and so on. I grew up in that, and so I came to varsity, and there's two kinds of schooling that I live in that space between those two kinds of schooling in some ways. I mean, I know in some respects my faith seems anachronistic, you know, that it, historically the mainstream Christianity, I'm probably still back with William Wilberforce at the turn of the 19th century or whatever, you know. In some respects, in terms of, you know, I believe in the truth of scripture, I believe in the resurrection and the virgin birth and all those apparently passe doctrines. I don't think of them as cultural forms, really. I both give assent to the story. I say, yeah, the Gospels, there's something there, someone there. But it's also a kind of real sense of encounter with the living God. So it's not just that I give assent to the story, but I do put my life, I know my life is in the hands of the one whom the story speaks about. that changes, I think, inevitably how I experience daily life and the kinds of questions I ask. And sometimes what a poem is. So the image on the cover is a Crookes radiometer, and it's a funny little instrument that when you stick it in the sun, the black and white veins spin. It only spins because there's a partial vacuum, so there's just enough gas molecules to flip around the veins and do their thing in the sun. And it's an image of inspiration. It's the light from beyond me, but also the sense of the emptying of the self, which is the enabling of the self to spin and hum. And yeah, the faith thing, yeah. I mean, it'll be really interesting for me to just journey with readers and see. It's a very interesting experience of launching the book in Wellington, and before I came away here, I wanted other people to read at the launch, so it's a kind of foretaste of readers reading. I didn't like hearing the poems. Part of me didn't like it. Part of me was just super grateful and it was lovely. Part of me didn't like it. Didn't like hearing the words in other people's mouth. What it was I realised in My Name is Ashilev, Chaim Potok describes this painter character's first exhibition, and he goes back the day after and the walls are blank. And he feels, because they're all sold, so it's a big success, but he feels very just gutted. And it wasn't the same, because obviously you can still buy the book for yourself and hold on to it, but there was a sense of the poems leaving me.
Mm-hmm.
And the knowledge that it was very proper, that if this is this experience of pushing out into language, language is a kind of gift. Not to talk about my giftedness, I mean language is something I've received that then leaves me. And it's really proper. These aren't my poems anymore, in some sense. Yeah, so I woke up to the reader, as it were, in a new way when that happened. It's a very strange experience.
Mm.
Yeah. It's good though.
Cute. Yeah, it's a bit like that, you know. I don't know, I don't have any babies, but I always think it must be like when you have to send your babies into the world let go of them.
You're only ever a steward as a parent of this person. Yeah.
On this poem.
Perhaps.
I could talk to you all day long, but I'm aware of time creeping on, so I'm thinking that it might be a good time to wrap up with a poem, but I really recommend you dash out and buy a copy of John Dennison's Otherwise. It's got a very beautiful dedication, you know, that it begins with, "For my mother and father who named me." It's really touching.
Yeah, it's a perilous thing to name a child. It's maybe it's kind of an poetic act that I was reaching for in some ways. But this is the last poem in the book, and I'll read it because it's dedicated to my mum and dad. When I was born, I had quite severe bilateral talipes, so club feet. It's like my original Oedipal complex. Severely deformed feet, so that I would have been walking on the arches of my feet. You can imagine, they're tucked right up, like kind of chook feet, you know, chickens. Aww. Yeah. And providentially, we were in a city where there was a surgeon pioneering a new, quite early postnatal operation on kids with. So I've never had to grow up with a sense of being a cripple, but that's also part of my story. So this poem is about that. It's called The Extra Mile, which, just to come back to the kind of biblical religious stuff, one of the questions for me is a writer who, you know, Someone once asked me, who are your influences? And I said, the prophet Isaiah is a pretty big influence, which just sounds totally hubristic, but it's kind of true that the book of Isaiah and the Gospels is just there in the background. And it is a question of how much that resonates with the readers. But the extra mile is from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. So there's all these trace elements through the language as well from there. Right, the extra mile for my mother and father. At first I turned out other than I should have been, both my feet, ponga fronds uptight and uncurling, wee question marks at the end of the good let there be, distempered parts questioned in turn, yes, by compassion, sharply, and turning out right enough to be going on with my unloosed ends. Love marked me, love shaped me, and this mothering grammar holds good still. At my birth, Voscot tut das is volgetan, my father sang with the Bach chorale, and what is done has entered me, left me longing for the extra mile.
Scottish Poetry Library podcast. For further information about the Scottish Poetry Library, visit our website at www.scottishpoetrylibrary.org.uk, follow us on Twitter at By Leaves We Live, and find us on Facebook.